Welcome to Tom Rhodes Radio. Thanks for listening. I want to start by saying I am in a tremendously good mood because this horrifically long cold winter is almost over and spring is almost here. Hooray! I want to start the program by saying hello, giving a shout out to Grace in Barcelona. She sent me some nice tweets saying she's loving the podcast. I tweeted her back, "Did you see me in Barcelona perform a few months ago?" She said, "No, I had no idea." So it turns out she's just a fan of the podcast. I have no idea how many people listen to my podcast, but judging from the messages I've got from people, it seems like my listeners are the coolest people and they're sprinkled all over the planet Earth. And it's my privilege to be in your eardrum. Speaking of Barcelona, I want to just say, while I was there, the coolest... Barcelona is probably my future home, people. The shaved pig leg alone is enough to move there for. But I got the greatest souvenir while I was in Barcelona, and I've been traveling with it. It's the Barcelona Football Club alarm clock, and this is what I wake up to whenever I have my alarm. It sounds a little like German marching music, but that's what I've been waking up to. Anyway, I think it's the coolest souvenir ever. This episode was recorded in London, England, and my guest is the award-winning author and filmmaker, Virginia Gilbert. She just got back from the Dublin Film Festival, where she premiered her brand new movie, A Long Way From Home. I've known Virginia for years. Her husband is the Irish comedian Keith Farnan, and they've become very good friends of ours, and I love talking with Virginia. She's one of my favorite people in the world, especially London, to joust with mentally. I knew her for years before I found out that her father is the acclaimed filmmaker Brian Gilbert. And I had never seen it until recently. He made a movie where Stephen Fry plays Oscar Wilde, and I swear to God, it's the best Oscar Wilde movie I've ever seen. Virginia talks about growing up on the set of that film being made, and that's why she ended up going to Trinity University in Dublin, because she loves Oscar Wilde. She's a very interesting person. She's got a lot of knowledge to share. I would say this episode is girl power personified. She's a badass, and she's someone I know you're gonna love getting to know. It's my pleasure to present to you now the one and only Virginia Gilbert. Virginia Gilbert, ladies and gentlemen. Virginia Gilbert. Now, you just got back from the Dublin Film Festival, yes, where you premiered your new film.
We had the Irish premiere, yeah.
And the boiler in your home just exploded.
It exploded. So, I was coming to meet you.
Can I get you some heroin?
No, I just would like a cup of tea.
Cigarette?
I mean, cigarette, no. I'm trying to cut down on
these cigarettes. Are like really stressful days for you, right?
Kind of stressful days, and work is exploding as well, so that's good. But yeah.
What was the premiere like in Dublin?
It was fantastic. It was absolutely fantastic. So the film had already premiered in the UK. So we premiered at the Edinburgh Film Festival in competition last year. Then it premiered in London for the release. Now the movie is opening in Ireland in 10 days, so they threw us a big gala screening, which was wonderful. So lots of champagne and lots of press, and our stars came over, so it was great.
How many premieres have you had with this film so far?
This is the third so far.
And you went to France?
We shot the film in France.
And yeah. I know that the funding was questionable when you got on the flight to go film it.
Ah, my husband's been talking to you. Yes, indeed. Yes, our finance had collapsed once.
So, I mean, you seem like a woman who is under constant stress.
It feels that way the last 3 years.
I couldn't imagine, because like with comedy, there's so much trust involved. And you fly around the world and you meet people you don't know based on a series of emails.
Yeah.
And you're going over to do probably one of the hugest projects of your life.
A film is
a human achievement up there with, marble structures, I think.
So depends on the movie or the structure.
What happened? How did that movie ever get made?
On a wing and a prayer and through luck, really. Well, luck, yeah. look, the legendary stories about film finance collapsing, it happens all the time. It had happened to us once already. We had been greenlit, and then one of our major financiers pulled out, as can often happen. Then there was a long scrabble, and we had to delay the production a couple of weeks. And by absolute luck, we managed to get it together with a replacement investor. But the deal was not completely sealed when I got on the plane to go prep for product for the shoot a couple of weeks later. So that was nerve-wracking.
Now, you wrote the book that turned
short
into
story.
This movie.
It was a short story originally that I adapted, yeah, for the screenplay, and then went off and directed, yes.
So how does that work with the BBC reads it, or I guess the BBC didn't make this film. But
no, I didn't go to the traditional financiers. Yes, you've got BBC Films, Film 4, the BFI over here. There's the Irish Film Board in Ireland, for example. All of these big state funders who often support local cinema, national cinema. But I avoided all of these guys on this one, so I didn't have to show anybody the script until I was ready to get the money together. And then because I went to a kind of to sort of private financiers, so people who had run commercials companies and were now beginning to invest in film and so on and so forth. And luckily, it's kind of like the dream scenario. They just loved the script and they loved the package and there were no issues. So
great, one of the rarities in
very,
show
very,
business.
Very, very rare.
Where literature meets show business.
Well, normally you get stuck in what's called development hell, which is where, you know, you are, because the whole development of the project is being funded by a major state financier, you are having to write to please them as well. You know, it can be tricky. So at least on this movie, I didn't have very much money, but I had total creative freedom. So that was great.
Have you heard about this guy that wrote True Detective? And he wrote his ass off.
Yeah.
And he's a first-time writer guy. He's got this red-hot television show. And
yes.
I was just reading about it in The Guardian yesterday, how the guy's got, like, total control over it. I mean, that is, like, the rarest thing in filmmaking ever.
Absolutely. It's what
or television, to have your own.
Yeah, television is breaking more ground, I think, these days than film, particularly in the States, and in terms of how open-minded they're being and how creative they're being, and the fact that for once, finally, the power and the respect seems to be back in the hands of the creatives, i.e. the writers primarily. It remains to be seen whether
I guess
that will translate.
Talentless suits screwed things up in so many repetitions.
Well, you'd like to think that they're still in their jobs.
Finally destroyed.
Well, I don't know about destroyed, but I think it's fantastic to see challenges to it. And, you know, if True Detective goes from strength to strength, as it seems to, it's a terrific model.
So would you prefer to make movies for television or movies for movies?
I prefer to make the projects I want to make, so I'll whore myself out happily wherever that will be, but you want to make as far as you can the films or stories, tell the stories you're interested in, and the aim is also to get them seen, so you know, I'm not choosy like that. It just so happens that thus far, for drama, film has been my primary medium. I've done a lot of television in documentaries and things like that, but I haven't undergone the big sort of drama development process in television.
But it was your intention to have this short story made into a film from the beginning?
Not from the beginning. No,
okay.
It became my intention. No.
Okay, it just sounds like this was your vision.
No, I was writing a lot of short fiction on the side, so I sort of had a debut collection of short stories, and I'd adapted one to be my debut short film, which went on and did quite well, and that enabled me to develop other screenplay ideas, feature length. And I did get stuck in development hell for a couple of years, where I was being financed by various state organizations. And things were just moving very, very slowly. Now, partly that was to do with the fact that, you know, the year I kind of broke through was the year the global recession hit, so that that didn't help cinema in general, and it certainly didn't help independent cinema. So I, you know, while I was gainfully employed in writing and making TV stuff, I was getting quite frustrated that, you know, a couple of years were going by and I hadn't been able to make another piece of drama. So I kind of said screw him and went off, and I knew this short story I could turn into a feature that was manageable, in other words, quite low budget. So that's kind of pragmatically.
And that was your first short film?
This was the feature film. That's how the feature film came about.
Okay, what is the feature film about?
It's called A Long Way From Home. It's set in the south of France. It is about an older couple who are played by James Fox, who's a wonderful English actor, and Brenda Fricker, who's Ireland's only Oscar-winning actress, fantastic actress. They have kind of retired to live the dream a bit in the south of France, even though they're not very well off. And she is loving it. She's getting on really well, having a great life, learning French and going shopping and so on. He is not having such an easy time. He's kind of restless and is not engaging with life very much. And when the spring and summer comes, the town, which is a beautiful little Roman town, loads of tourists arrive, and he loves this time of year because he gets distracted. He can sort of talk to some of the Brits or Irish who come over and so on. And by chance, one evening at their local little cafe, they meet a young couple from England who are there on holiday for a few days. And he and the young woman of the couple really connect. And I'm not going to tell you much more than that, except to say he falls devastatingly in love with her.
Wow.
And it provokes a serious crisis. So it's quite a tender, subtle, and quite a moving film, I guess.
Everything falls apart at the bed and breakfast.
Well, I'm not going to say anything more. Certainly all my actors, and Brenda Fricker, who's been doing a lot of press for the movie in Ireland, has been very cagey about giving away too much, and she's right, because actually the ending is quite surprising.
I'm a Francophile. You've already got me hooked. So,
Fabien, monsieur.
How is it being received? Like, how's...
I'm delighted, to be honest with you. For a tiny, tiny little film, and we didn't have any distribution when we started making the film, we got picked up by a terrific sort of art house independent distributor, because that's the major hurdle. I mean, you can just about get a film made, but getting it seen and getting it out there is huge. So I'm just thrilled that Soda Pictures, who are a great company here, picked it up for a UK and Irish theatrical, and they'll handle television sales here and the DVD release and all of that. How has it been received? Look, it's definitely not a film for everybody. It is quite a subtle film. It's not a big blockbuster piece. But generally speaking, the audiences who it's aimed for, in other words, perhaps a slightly older audience or the kind of the more art housey crowd, and also weirdly, younger women seem to really go for it. They have responded fantastically.
Because
well.
They're in bad relationships and they want to.
I just think they respond. No,
perfect ideals. They
no, not
meet
at
by
all.
Chance.
Quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. If anything, I think they respond to the sort of the quarter life crisis that our heroine, our younger heroine, is crisis is the wrong word, but our younger heroine, who's played by Natalie Dormer, who's in Game of Thrones and The Tudors and Rush, she's quite a star in the States now. Is on the cusp of 30, and I think for women that's quite a transitional decade. So a lot of young women are responding to the kind of things she's agonizing about. So that's
well,
really
I mean, you know, there's got to be a better term than midlife crisis. I mean, we're talking
it's
about women in their
term.
30s, but it's not... I mean, so many people in cycles
I think
of your life...
life stage truck crisis.
That's what I'm saying. There's so many people in the cycles of your life in each of your decades.
Absolutely.
Where it seems you... I've come to a crossroads where, you know, which direction do I go? Should I follow my heart with this person?
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
You think that's, that's a pretty...
Listen, I think in the one sense, if we stopped asking these questions, life, you may as well give up. Life is all about answering these big questions and making and re-questioning yourself every few years. But there's no doubt that the older one gets, I think, the more potent these questions can become. You know, because a sense of time is changing and a sense of one's energy as well. I mean, you know, we're still relatively young, but I can already feel now at 33, I don't have the energy I had at 23.
True.
For sure. And I never thought I'd hear myself say that, but it's, you begin to become aware that those questions have just a very different weight because your resources are different, you know.
I read a thing recently somewhere, and it was some psychology breakdown of why relationships don't work out. And I think it was a quote that said, the reason most relationships don't work out is because...
They're with comedians. No.
That
sorry.
Was
sorry, sorry.
That was the number one.
Really?
No. It said the reason a lot of relationships don't work out is because men love too many and women love too much.
Well, that's interesting because Brenda Fricker, when she was interviewed last week on Irish TV, was asked about her her late husband. Her husband died. She was widowed quite young. And she was asked, why did you never remarry or fall in love? And she said, well, I've found in my experience that men move on, but women grieve. I don't know how true it is. I mean, it's kind of like echoing a truism like that. I am very wary of all those generalizations. You know, I happen to have found a husband who I think is quite the opposite of what you've just said, that men love too many and women love too much.
Your husband loves too much.
Well, I don't know, not too much. I think he loves absolutely correctly. For me.
I love your husband, just say, Keith Farnan. We worked together in Dublin. That's how we all met.
That's how we became friends.
Yeah. I saw him two nights ago. I think he just gets better and better. And
it's this
wild Irish poet thing that he's, I mean, and that's
with
like,
such a brain.
That's purity. That's,
He's fantastic. I'm not saying loves too much. I suppose,
I can see he's a passionate.
Well, it's the old cliche, isn't it? That men are fickle and men are, you know, whereas women are very constant, but that's an idea. Those are ideas that go back to the Victorian era. I don't know quite how true that is about human nature. I think generally, if you want to make a generalization, women have been known to be perhaps a little bit more rooted in real life, but that's primarily because of their biology. You know, if women have to go through the shit of childbearing and are going to be responsible for a kid, I think generally it makes them a little bit more rooted in the day-to-day, whereas men perhaps have afforded to live a bit more in the clouds. But, you know, the gender relations are changing so much in the modern world, and as more and more women choose not to have children, as more and more women choose to live independently, a lot of things are shifting, I think.
Well, and making a film is kind of like having a baby.
Very much like having a baby. almost right. Like changing shitty nappies, frankly. But it's certainly a production and a half, yes. No sleep. No sleep, lots of crying.
Lots of crying.
A lot of late night bottles, I think, as well, is the other thing. It's a little like motherhood, except it's a much shorter time period because, of course, once the movie's finished, you let it go out into the world, but you haven't had to wait normally 18 years, hopefully. So it's good. It's a more rewarding, quicker cycle, I think.
How does the process work? So you got money from, like, government?
Not for this one, but for the next one, it's looking that way, yes.
Wow,
yes.
That's incredible. Yes, I mean, you don't have to, like, deal with coked-out sleazeballs in Los Angeles.
Oh, sure you do, of course. On the last one. Yeah, look, people, there's... Also, these days in filmmaking, unless you're with a Hollywood studio, the money never comes from one source. So it's a jigsaw puzzle of finance. You get your finance from usually a minimum of 3 to 4, but sometimes 7 or 8 different sources. And usually that's from quite a few different countries and quite a few different organizations. So, for example, on this new film, I have 5 producers, 3 in France, 1 in England, 1 in Ireland, who are getting money from not only all of their countries, but also some international deal, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a real... That's the hardest part, is putting that jigsaw together. And luckily, I don't have to actively go out and do that myself, but the producers do that on the film's behalf, although, you know, I work in close collaboration on that side of things. The last one was a bit of an anomaly. That was quite a unique situation. This next one, which we're hoping is going to shoot in May, is proving to be more traditional.
What is your greatest hope for a film, like your next film? Like, so you're kind of in the...
Is that it's good.
Well, I mean, but you're in the driver's seat now,
yes.
Right? Because
yes.
your last film was a success.
Yes.
And it's being premiered all over right now. So
yes.
So you got a little more confidence going into the next project.
What you always hope is that you can make another one. To be perfectly honest with you, what you want to achieve... I mean, obviously, privately... The major thing that I want to achieve with any piece of work is that I'm satisfied that it's a good piece of work, that it's something that I believed in, that it's something I can come away after 2 or 3 years of my life on it and say, yep, that holds up, and that it's something I'm happy to let go out into the world. So that's the most important side of it. On a career side, you want it to get enough attention or notice, particularly in the industry, in order that you can go on and keep working. That's what you hope for.
I never went to university.
Okay. You could have fooled me.
And I basically got my I mean, I'm an avid reader and yeah. I'm always reading and stuff. But
and you've traveled the world.
And I've traveled the world. But yeah. Before all that, I mean, I was educated on films. Like you said, you worked in documentaries. Okay. I mean, when I moved to San Francisco and the art house cinemas yeah. there, the foreign films, I lived with a French woman and we would go see.
That's where my dad got his film education, was San Francisco.
Really?
Yeah.
You're
yeah,
kidding.
Before he went to film school, yeah. He lived there for a year.
The art house cinemas. He had the exact experience that I did.
Absolutely.
I was going to and I remember, as a comedian, I did a benefit to Save the Roxy Theater, which was in yeah. the Mission, and they were one of the best. And I said that when I was on stage, that, you know, okay. you can't let this place close.
Yeah.
Because
it's a piece of history.
Well, I mean, for me, I'd educate all the Betty Blue. I mean, and then the Castro Theater mm-hmm. showed old classic films. But like yeah. Knowledge of the world, wanting to travel the world.
Yes.
And then also, I've always been obsessed with documentaries. I love documentaries.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Film for me has been my university.
Wow.
So
wow. You must have one hell of a view of the world there with a couple of the films you've just mentioned there. No, listen, you know, film has been from its inception and continues to be in certain forms, you know, a genuine art form. Absolutely. But like any form of art / entertainment, and I would say the same absolutely for the publishing industry, the music industry, you can cover a lot of ground. So you're catering, and the industries as a whole are catering to huge, broad numbers of people and tastes. And it's true that 80 to 90% of what's made is pure fodder, just market fodder. But it is still, I think, a vital art form, cinema. And I would include television in that these days as well, particularly the kind of storytelling that's coming out of America. So, you know, for people who love movies and are passionate about their movies, it is a fantastic education.
So your father did he and then your
he's
father
a filmmaker,
he's
yes.
a very director. Well-known filmmaker. Mm-hmm. The hugest film that he made.
Well, he's made a few films. He made in America. He made a kind of an 80s classic called Vice Versa, which was still gets shown at Christmas every year, which is quite fun.
Is that when John Travolta and what's his name?
Judge Reinhold and Fred Savage. That's Face Off, my.
Oh, okay.
I All wish he'd right. made that one. I'd have had a house by now. But Vice Versa did pretty good. So he made a couple of movies out in Hollywood. And then he made some films back in the UK. One of them was called Tom and Viv, which was about the poet T.S. Eliot. So that had Willem Dafoe and Miranda Richardson in it. Did very well. And the film that got me very interested in moving to Ireland, which was a film called Wild, about Oscar Wilde with Stephen Fry and Jude Law.
Oh, your father made that?
He made that,
wow,
yeah.
Fantastic.
So that got me interested. That's how I ended up going to Trinity College Dublin.
No shit.
Because I was researching the movie. I was about 16 when they were making that.
You went to Trinity? That is
I did,
damn.
Because of Oscar Wilde. And my favorite thing about Trinity
I respect
College.
You so deeply for
oh,
that.
Oh, bless you. No, Trinity.
I would like to be a lot more like Oscar Wilde, but without all of that pesky cocksucking.
Oh, now. How else are you going to pass a Saturday night, for God's sake? But you know, the best thing is, he's one of Trinity College's most famous alumni. You know, they've got quite a few, but obviously he's up there. And they have statues to lots of their other ones.
And he was trouble every minute he was there, right?
They have statues to like Edmund Burke and Oliver Goldsmith and all these people out front of Trinity. They do have a little bust of Oscar Wilde. Do you know where they've put it?
Mm-mm.
In the entrance to the genetics department. I'm not joking, which I just find hilarious. So the Irish kind of want to celebrate him, but in the right way. So, yeah. Yeah.
So was it obviously your father must have made you fall in love with film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he has a pathetic anecdote that when I was born, literally within the first couple of minutes, and they put me to my mother's breast, and I made you know, the milk was bubbling slightly, and he swears in that bubbly moment he heard me say Bertolucci, and was convinced from there on in that I'd be a filmmaker.
A genius is born.
I know. He tell me about it.
From your earliest, like other kids are doing finger painting, and you're watching like French noir films.
One of the first films he showed me was at two. I watched Ingmar Bergman. The Magic Flute, so I could get both the Mozart music and watch a movie and start to read with the subtitles. So I had an extraordinary film education. I mean, he was kind of nuts, to be honest with you, but yes.
I think that's gorgeous. I think that's exactly what I would
watching,
do with my kid.
Yeah, I was watching. So I never had that feeling. And I think actually my parents gave me an extraordinary education because I was just immersed in great movies from all over the world, classical music, poetry. My mother had been a publisher and became a teacher, taught literature. So that... And actually, when I look back on it, what it meant was that nothing was ever alien or frightening to me. None of those forms, so classical music or opera or poetry or classic literature or art house movies, because it was just there from the beginning, you know. So that's a hell of a thing.
So what were the earliest movies that grabbed you?
This is going to sound terminally pretentious, but the ones that I remember most vividly from childhood... And I mean, early childhood were Bergman's The Magic Flute, Laurence Olivier's Hamlet, which I can't believe he showed me, but he did.
Wow.
And I thought was in Swedish because the Bergman had been in Swedish. I clearly didn't understand the Shakespeare. La Belle et la Bête, the Cocteau, which is Beauty and the Beast, one of the most stunning, stunning, stunning films ever made. Have you ever seen it?
No, Cocteau.
With the best special effects in the world. They have never been matched by any sort of CGI. It's magical. It was made just after the war ended in France. They had no money, no resources. It's incredible. So that stands out from childhood. Then, of course, some children's classics and some musicals, which were great for kids. So West Side Story I loved. Watership Down, the animated film, Railway Children, Treasure Island, a lot of the kind of the real old-fashioned kids movies. But yes, and then later into sort of my kind of, I suppose, 9, 10, 11, starting to watch Coppola's and Scorsese's and those kinds of films. When I was a little younger, actually, the ones I also loved were French New Wave movies. So Jules Legim, those kind of 400 Blows, which are actually fantastically accessible for kids. Bicycle Thieves, The De Sica. Great movies for children, actually, a lot of them.
I lived with a French woman in San Francisco for many years. And
you're still standing.
Saw a lot of French films. And most French films, at the end, everybody dies.
Not all of them.
I mean, I'm sorry. They don't die, but I'm sorry. Every French film has a shitty ending.
That is such a cliche. Sorry, Tom.
And it could be a comedy. And everyone, I got...
Bullshit.
I got a hold of Betty Blue, a film that I loved.
Betty Blue.
In the 90s.
You know, I met that actor.
And then I hadn't seen it in years. I watched it. I went, oh, yeah. The girl gets cancer and dies at the end.
Yeah, Betty Blue.
It's a lighthearted comedy for 45 minutes.
Hardly that. She's a woman on the verge of a suicidal breakdown. But no, I would disagree with you. I know people. It's a lovely label to paint French movies. And sure, there's ones that are like watching paint dry, and there's others that you can only go and see if you're...
Who was the female French director we talked about the other night? Who?
Oh, you were talking about Catherine Breillat, who made Romance X.
Is she like a feminist filmmaker or no?
She calls herself one, yeah. Okay. I haven't seen enough of her work to truly judge. Well, I wasn't a fan of Romance X particularly. I quite liked a film she made called Amasseur for my sister. But there are two other women working in France who I think are fantastic directors, and not everybody
knows.
Who's that? One of them is called Agnès Jaoui. Agnes, as in, you know, the English. Jaoui, it's a strange name. But she makes the most fabulous social comedies. So she's made films called The Taste of Others, Look at Me, Let's Talk About the Rain. She and her husband co-write them. She directs. They're both in them. They are fantastic. They're the most moving, charming, funny, touching movies.
What's her name again?
Agnes. So Agnes Jaoui. I think it's J-A-U-O-I.
Thank you.
She's fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. So look at her stuff. And then the other one is a real... a real auteur. Her name is Mia Hansen-Love, and she's made a couple of movies, one called The Father of My Children, which did quite well on the festival circuit. A very beautiful, mature film. She's a young woman, she's only in her early 30s, but the films she's making are so sensitive and mature, and again, just really meaty subjects, and just she's just fantastic.
What do you think about the big hoopla about women directors and women filmmakers? Like, I mean, shouldn't we be beyond that description? Like, I remember it was like the first black, and growing up in the States, the first black person to do this, first black person to do that, or the first woman to do this. I mean, shouldn't we be beyond
It's funny, I hadn't
expected
it.
Where, I mean, that's even a consideration, or?
That was the main feat, all the press I did over the weekend for Ireland, and I was quite surprised. Everybody wanted to talk about that. I guess because statistically it's true that there are still far fewer female directors than men. Where women are directing more, it's very much in the independent art house area. Women are not being handed mainstream movies for the most part. And a lot of people were asking me why I thought that is. I think there are a number of reasons for it. And I also have to say, I feel very torn about it. I think there is a lot that could still be done to help female directors and to help them progress in their careers. On the other hand, it's true, I do occasionally resent being called a female film director. I'm just a storyteller. So, you know, on the one hand...
So your gender is being spoken of first before your talent.
Yeah, but I think that's just given the circumstances that it's still relatively unusual.
Well, I mean, maybe there should... I mean, so what do you think about a feminist declarative statement in film?
In what sense?
About, women making, like the Agnes woman you were talking
Agnes
about.
Agnes Shawi. Well, I mean, look.
And, you know, it sounds like, you know, your story in the south of France has a lot of sexual politics and life pondering. A woman is the life giver. I mean,
I think it's, yeah.
It's a woman's perspective.
I think there is.
Look at Pussy Riot, you know? I mean, they're a punk rock, feminist, anarchist.
Yeah.
Art squad, whatever you would call them.
Right, sure. Well, listen, are you asking me, do women have something to say in cinema? Absolutely they do. And do women have something to say in writing? Of course they do. And usually what they've got to say is incredibly interesting. It's, first of all, having the support structures in place that they can actually go in, and particularly in film, go in and make a career in the business. And that... actually being a director specifically. There are a lot of women who work in production roles, and that's fantastic to see, and the more the better. And even women now working very much in the technical side of things, editors, cinematographers. But directing is such an all-consuming process. It is not very conducive often to a female rhythm, in the sense that you know, imagine trying to combine a career and a family as a director. It is 24/7. Particularly when you're making a film. And when you're not making a film and are trying to get one off the ground, it can be pretty 24/7 as well. So there's a lot of areas in which I think filmmaking is off-putting for women, or just seems quite removed. The other side of it too is the fact that with the explosion of technology, a lot of boys go crazy for the techno-geek aspect of it, and I think a lot of women can sometimes be put off by that side of it. The fact is, you don't really need to know your ass from your elbow hugely when it comes to discussing lenses or exposures. That's what you have your cinematographer for. What you do need to do is know how to communicate what you want and be as immersed visually and poetically as you can be. So go and see a lot of art, go and look at a lot of other movies. But in terms of big declarative statements, this is where I get very torn, because it's why I'd be against quotas and so on. You know, you can only, people can only and should only move forward on the basis of their talent. However, the film business is a very unjust business. And there are plenty of average to low talented male directors working out there, as well as plenty of extraordinarily talented ones. It just seems interesting to me that they, you know, there'd be such a swathe of people at the middling ranks, and that's where you don't see many women.
Well, I mean,
you know what I mean?
It's, yeah, the power.
Listen, you have the same issue with women in comedy.
It's true,
and people get asked that question.
But I mean, it's the power of storytelling, and I think women have.
Women are as capable, if not more so, than anybody else.
They have the strongest stories to tell.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I tend to sit on the fence with this kind of thing, but certainly they have huge stories to tell. But let me flip it, because our industries are not that dissimilar. Why do you think there aren't more women in comedy? It's not because women can't be funny or don't have things to say.
Well, I think the difference between comedy and filmmaking is that the travel, the incessant travel and the low level of travel. I know female comedians, and I've talked about it on this show.
So you mean work and family.
Patty Vasquez, she very attractive, mm-hmm. woman from Chicago, and to start in the Midwestern circuit, she had to sleep in her car in rest areas.
Yeah.
And she would park in church parking lots instead of rest areas safe. So she wouldn't get raped.
Yeah.
And so I think that early obstacle keeps a lot of women out of comedy. But England's different. You can do comedy and still all over the country and still sleep in your own bed in London.
So you, in some ways, then the obstacles
but
are
But I think, I mean, you
film.
Know, I think the filmmaking falls more into like the art world, or I don't know, it's all show business and art.
Yeah, and look, there are huge degrees. There are degrees of comedians as there are degrees of filmmakers. You know, there are people who absolutely only want to go out and make the next tentpole movie. You know, their passion is to go and make Spider-Man 6 or X-Men 4, which Keith would love me to do. I'm sure that's probably already been made. And that's one very, you know, that's a very different goal and desire with what you want from your career and from your working life than I would have, say. I think I have a feeling there are big overlaps as to why women aren't so much in comedy as in film. And I think a lot of it is the practical hurdles and the working hours and the fact that these are traditionally very much geared to a male temperament. Late nights, lot of late night networking.
Carousing.
Boozing, a lot of the networking happens late night, you know.
Yeah.
That, you know, is not quite so geared to a woman's energy, or certainly I haven't found so. But women have to do it. Where you see women doing extremely well in film is in producing. Less so in directing. I think just... Well, the demands of both are very big, but I don't know. I don't know. It's hard to know why. It's hard to know why. I think there are a lot of factors.
You know? I think film is humankind's greatest achievement, and nothing can influence humanity more than films.
Really? Yeah. Over medicine?
Well, I mean, that's why I wish there would be more, less superhero bullshit, or put in some love everybody messages within the superhero film.
I mean, film
you know,
is the most...
If, like, the next Batman could show, like, Jews and Palestinians and, you know,
hugging and kissing.
Everybody.
Wow. Am I going to get the next Obama t-shirt from you again? Tom was insisting I wore
it. Oh, yeah, we need to stay away from politics. Mm-hmm. I remember... one of our earliest conversations was about
a yelling match.
the death penalty. You got
I'm very anti the death penalty.
Yeah, and so you got miffed at me because I said I was completely against the death penalty, with the exception of child molesters, and that
reformed,
and that, you know, like the ones that rape and murder kids.
Okay.
Those people.
Yeah.
I got no sympathy
for
those fucking. They should
just be gone.
And I'm totally against the death penalty and humans doing that. And we had this big conversation, but I want you to know, I read recently. Yeah. You were right. I read recently about how Russia castrates child molesters. So
yeah, the chemical castration.
I can adopt that program, and now I'm against.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So you can just take castration.
Now I'm on
over
your
death.
Team.
Oh, wow.
Now I'm on your team.
Listen, it's not.
I am officially completely against the death penalty.
You're officially a great liberal.
But it took
then.
That.
If it's castration.
It took that idea.
Okay. I think the only thing I would not happily see those people walking the streets. My only ever concern with the death penalty is should someone innocent fall victim to it. And it's not a fail-safe system.
Yeah, by not by any means. Yeah, and it's very unfair and lopsided. And
as far as I'm concerned, if one human being, if one innocent person dies at the hands of the state under that system, to me, it negates the whole thing. It just does.
Yeah. Well, I'm from...
So castration, no problem.
Florida is the number two state for...
Oh, who's number one?
Texas. Yeah, but I mean, Florida...
But you're smaller than Texas, right?
Well, no. Populations are... pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a factory machine.
Well,
it seems to have slowed down
it,
in the last like 5 years, but Texas and Florida, they're...
Yeah. Well, I mean, I learned most about it when I first met my husband, because he had literally just started touring his first ever stand-up show on the death penalty. Because he, prior to being a comedian, of course, had been a lawyer, and... had worked for a number of summers down with the Innocence Project and in Georgia, trying to get death row cases overturned. In other words, make sure that they were valid, make sure that all the evidence had been checked. And I mean, it is extraordinary the system you have in the States, and that the death penalty is the, almost the biggest political weapon, the sort of the human argument aside, that people, politicians won't get elected unless they're seen to be tough on crime, and the death penalty is a very big part of that. But it is quite scary, and I think your legal system is quite scary in that there's no real legal aid for the underclass, for those who can't afford it. Now, legal aid has just been slashed over here in England, but we still have it, and it, frankly, it's one of the things I'm proudest of about England.
Really? You get that too? Healthcare and...
healthcare and legal aid, yeah. Everybody is entitled to a properly qualified lawyer here when if you're arrested, no matter whether you can pay them or not. Whereas, as I understand it, certainly through my husband in America, you will be given legal representation.
A court-appointed attorney.
It could be the dregs of the dregs.
And as I know from people who have gone through the experience, they don't show up half the time. They barely look into
your
cases.
There's no incentive for them. They've got nothing to... So it's a pretty unfairly weighted system, I think.
What are the other benefits of,
of American
English
law?
Superiority?
Tea? A marvellous accent? I don't know. Downton Abbey seems to have done quite well over in...
Oh, people are apeshit for it.
Yeah, what? Yeah. Have you seen it? I've never seen it.
It's
just like posh.
Whenever I turn it on, they're eating.
Oh, really? Oh, so it's food porn.
Whenever I turn it on, they're eating. Flipping through the channels and saw, oh, this is Downton Abbey. I'll watch it for a minute. And there's always like a big, long table shot. And people are eating. And it's like the worst stereotype. Because, you know, we do have the stereotype that English people have bad teeth.
Yes, which we do.
They're these like classy looking, dressed up people. And they're all eating like animals.
Just sounds like animals. A brilliant export. Well, at least for once you get to laugh at the Brits, I guess, you know. I don't think the
you do have such superior storytelling, and I mean, you obviously you love Ireland.
No, not anymore. Look at
no,
American
but I mean
TV.
Historically, and then,
historically, but so
I think the BBC has made like the best documentaries.
Not anymore.
You got such
America has
film history and literature history.
America is
stories.
The leader in film history.
How do you feel the weight of that as an English person? Like,
I wake up with the weight of it every morning.
Standing on the shoulders of giants.
Oh, I don't think about it that way. I think I would disagree with you. I mean, I think the Americans have led the way always in terms of a certain kind of very accessible story. Guns and violence, and the notion of what it is to be a hero, and the notion of goodness. I mean. Let's talk about let's talk about the superiority of the Americans for a little bit. The Americans are, generally speaking, the most charitable and generous race in the world compared to any of the other stingy, uptight Europeans. And that's a remarkable thing. They're also
we give more than anybody in every crisis.
You do. And it's not only, but right down to an individual level. And I think, you know, I've noted, because also America is so much more tolerant. Britain thinks it's very tolerant, but we're not really. And I'm not talking racially tolerant. I'm talking tolerance of the non-Guardianista mainstream views. America has actually total religious tolerance. Every single town in the States will have its varying denominational churches and this, that, and the other. And indeed, I still believe, even though it's probably quite unfashionable to say, that the religious awareness in America and the fact that it's still a much more church-going society gives people a stronger sense of community and a stronger sense of charity. And I speak as a total atheist. But I'm always hugely impressed with the kindness of Americans, just generally, right down to the individual level. And, of course, all your serial killers.
We got some great, killers for some reason.
We do. We love crime.
Women love serial killers.
Women are the biggest
killers.
Buyers of crime fiction, hands down. Violent fiction.
Women are the only ones I know who read like biographies about serial killers.
Well, my first novel is I'm not going to say too much, but is nasty.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
This is the novel you're working on?
No, it's the one that was just published.
It was just published, and it's about a serial killer.
No, it's not about a serial killer, but it's nasty. It's the kind of
novel. Is there murder? And
I'm not going to say much. Mm-hmm. Something horrific happens.
Yeah. Something horrific that a woman's mind could conceive of.
Absolutely.
Did you see this woman in the newspaper last week? This English woman that was like stabbing. She killed like three people.
I read about that, but
with the help of like two goons
I haven't read
that
much
she possessed
about
with whatever sexual
charm.
Hypnosis. Yeah, it said sexual charm.
Oh, did
paper.
It say that? It didn't say booze.
So what does it mean? She's like, I'll blow you if you like.
Probably stab
protect
this
me
guy.
While I stab this guy.
I don't know. Obviously, I've been out of the dating game for a long time.
How come England doesn't have
it does.
Crazy killers?
Oh, it does. It does.
When? What was that guy that was on the loose 3 years ago?
Fred West, Peter Sutcliffe. We've had loads.
Who was your greatest serial killer? I mean,
in terms of numbers.
Shouldn't say greatest, in terms of numbers.
Oh, I don't know. I actually don't know between the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, or Fred West. I mean, we had the Moors murderers. We've had a lot. I can't. Now you've put me on the spot, but we've had a lot of serial killers. Too many, probably. And the one that's just come up now, actually, because I wasn't reading so much about the English woman who stabbed, is this Craigslist killer. Have you heard about this?
No, David.
She's confessed to, or is claiming she's murdered over 100, or just under 100 people.
And this is in England?
I think this is in America.
Oh.
I think. But I have to confess, I'm out of the loop with the news over the last 5 days.
Yeah, there was some weird shit a few years ago where, like, people were, you know, going to buy a coffee table on Craigslist.
And then we're met
some,
by
it was some guy. He went to some farm and hunted them. Him and some other.
It's like that in the 50s. So
that's not a good advertisement for Craigslist.
But they've been doing that for years.
Fucking kill.
Well, yeah.
I just wanted one bedroom apartment.
I didn't want a knife in my back.
City.
But what about the Lonely Hearts Murders? Do you remember that?
Uh-oh,
that goes. And there's a movie made of that in the 50s. So all these, you know, people would write into Lonely Hearts columns, and a killer. And indeed, his screwed-up mistress would respond and woo these often little old ladies or sad middle-aged women, strike up a relationship, the man and the woman, and they would murder them for the money. So it's not a new phenomenon.
Charming.
Talking as if I'm a crime expert, but yeah.
So you've written one book?
I've written one novel, and I've got a collection of short stories, a lot of which have been published sort of separately, but we're seeing about trying to get them done as a collection now. First movie out. I'm working on the second one now, hoping that's coming together to shoot very soon.
What's your next film going to be about?
Next film is very different in tone and feel to the first one. The next one is quite explosive drama, centering around a little girl who accuses somebody of abuse. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Wow.
So it's quite an explosive drama.
Nasty.
Yeah, it is.
There's always nasty shit.
Quite dark. Quite dark. Yeah. It's good, though. It's good. Real character piece, and we've got some fantastic actors lined up, so I'm pleased.
What about writing a book? Is that, does that germinate in your mind over a few years? Are you gaining momentum on, all right, when I have time to attack?
No, it came about.
Idea, or does it just come to you?
Well, I've only done it once so far, thinking about the second one. But it was something that just felt very instinctive. It was a story idea. I didn't know where the story was going to go, but there was a story idea I had that initially I thought might be something I'd want to write as a screenplay or something. But actually, the more I got into it, the more I realized it was suitable for novel form, and I thoroughly enjoyed doing that. And I had been wanting to write a novel, something to bridge the gap between short fiction and so on, you know, to move on from short stories, as I'd done in film, as it were, moving from the shorter form to longer forms. So it all happened rather organically, actually. It wasn't something that was planned miles ahead, so just sat down and wrote it, you know, got on with it, which is kind of the art of writing, really, isn't it? Just sit down and do it.
And just do it.
Just do it.
Get on with it.
Yeah.
I liked that J.K. Rowling, the one quote, I never read any of those books. She said, don't tell me you can't write. I was a single mother. And she said, even if you just write one page a day of your book, you're moving forward on it.
Yes. The key for me, honestly, the key I've found with certainly writing the novel, which is the longest piece I've ever written, is just the daily discipline of it. Now, a lot of people do it in different ways. Some people say I'm going to write for 6 hours every day and blah, blah, blah. I found the easiest way for me was to set myself a word count every day. And no matter how long or how short it took, I had to hit that word count. And even if things were going really well, I would stop at that word count.
Really?
Because that's the discipline. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So some days hit my word count would take an hour and a half. Some days it could take 6 hours if it was going really badly, but that was how I did it. Other people will do it differently. But I did find...
What was your daily word count?
I'm trying to remember offhand. I think it was about 2,500 words a day, something like that. Which meant I got a first draft in about 5 weeks.
I recently stopped drinking, and I'm kind of getting into a different rhythm in my life where I've always been out drinking late at night, like we talked about earlier in this conversation. Yes. The next day you're, recovering from a hangover. I'm enjoying not having hangovers. So like this concept of a full, fresh day is kind of a new thing for me.
Okay.
But I like what you were telling me the other night about. So you wake up in the morning and you write, and then you go walk or run for an hour?
Actually, these days I get up quite early. I try to. I like to get up quite early if I've had enough sleep. And if it's a writing day, because my days can be different depending if I'm in production or if things are moving towards production. But if it's purely a writing day, I will usually go straight for a long walk. I won't even change. I'll be in my pajamas and I'll go march around the quiet bit of where I live and spend about an hour just waking up and being out in nature a bit. Then I'll write. And then
I love that idea that and you're also, your ideas are starting to swirl.
Yeah. My habit has slightly changed in that I tell a slight lie. These days I do go straight from my bed to my desk for 20 minutes before I go for my walk, writing just a sort of a journal very, very quickly. And that's great. And then I'll go for my walk and then I'll come back to actually work on what I'm supposed to work on. And then I'll spend most of the day at my desk and then go for a run or something in the afternoon or evening to let the day go. And also walking is hands down the best writer's troubleshooting tool. It's where the idea, more so than running, although thoughts, things or problems will bubble away when running, but somehow the rhythm of walking is definitely the best problem solving tool for me.
That's great. Yeah. Walking is one of my favorite things, going to different cities around the world and just walking and walking and walking.
Absolutely. It's the only way to see the place and feel the place and soak it up. But you...
My cousins in Argentina, when I was in Buenos Aires, I just wanted to walk, and they kept going.
Wow.
When they would ask me what I want to do today, they would go, Caminar.
Yeah, go walking. Walk. Absolutely. But Jesus, you really have seen the world. And, I think it's very hard for comedians to maintain a reasonably regular day to day because your work, you often don't finish till 2 in the morning. And it's a struggle that Keith has because he actually likes to keep regular hours. He likes to be up reasonably early, have the day. It's very hard when you're on the road and it's very hard when you're not finishing work. And then the adrenaline surge going down till 3 o'clock in the morning. So it's tough, I think, because so many comedians, quite rightly, also have other writing projects they want to do. And I think...
Well, you and Keith are a very interesting, just super productive couple. The one-man shows he's done, like he did his first one on the death penalty. His second one was on
racism.
Racism. And then the third one was on
women's
feminism.
Women's rights. And then the
women's rights.
One was
and
on
that
the
was
economy.
Funny when he was doing that and you and I were talking, you told me...
Oh, he's more of a feminist than I am.
He's more of an extreme feminist than I am.
Yeah, he was then, anyway.
Which, in turn, Keith, to me, is this quintessential Irish poet.
Yeah, that's lovely.
And, so you got your Trinity College wild man.
Well, he wasn't from Trinity. Not at Trinity College. I just want to point out to the world he went to University College Cork.
So, Keith isn't your, he's not a party. Never seen him out all night, he's a pretty hardworking guy in his own right, and a thinker as well, as which you are. You guys work, I'd like to know how you guys inspire each other or help each other.
A huge amount. I mean, what is lovely is that we both work from, when I'm writing and when he's at home, we are both working from home during the day. He reads everything I do, which is invaluable, and likewise I would for him. When he's preparing the one-man shows, because he's now done 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He's done 5 in the last five years. then I will come and watch those previews and hopefully give some input as he's developing them. No, I mean, I hope we're great resources for each other, because we do share a lot of what's going on. And then another big way we help one another is to give each other space. We're not demanding on each other's time, particularly in terms of being needy or emotionally needy, so we're quite respectful of each other's workspace. Though we try and carve out enough time together. Not always easy, but we do. And then, of course, just emotionally and temperamentally supportive of each other, because the business, both our businesses are crap, you know. It's a roller coaster every day. You can get fantastic news on one thing and shit.
Well, that's
kind of,
if you can only feel good about yourself for
5 minutes,
three minutes at a time.
Right.
So I mean, something great happens, or you get a go ahead on an email and something else waiting for an answer for it.
Exactly.
Disaster.
So knowing thing that falls and keeping each other balanced and as zen as possible is, I think, the biggest asset. Just helping each other's temperaments and trying to enjoy the domestic life together. You know, we do enjoy our domestic life. We're bloody boring, you know. We don't go out very much. That's all really important, I think, and not allowing each other to get so over-consumed by our work that we miss out on what we're here for, which is, you know, to enjoy our lives.
What is the greatest challenge of being in a relationship with a comedian?
Bloody hell. Ironing. Cleaning.
Oh, really?
The greatest challenge. Well, look, for sure, the schedule, the traveling is difficult. You know, it's a bloody demanding lifestyle. You know, you're on the road. You're like musicians. You're on the road all the time. So the biggest challenge is carving out time together. And I think also the challenge of any freelancer, not just comedians, is knowing when to say yes and knowing when actually it's probably better to say no. And that's hard, you know, like, no, you know what? No, we're going to take a holiday and we're going to do it. But essentially, no, it's the time issue. It's finding time together. Nobody likes to turn down work, but, you know, for example, this week, Keith happens to be gigging every single night this week. Normally we try and keep it to 3 or 4 nights, because otherwise you don't have a life together.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to travel with him. I'm too busy. I can't travel with him. I'm not going to, you know.
Right. And when you're making a film, that's got to, you.
Yeah. Well, Keith was great that way. We worked out a balance. The year I was shooting, he didn't do Edinburgh, because also the Edinburgh Festival, if you do that every year, the entire year revolves around it, quite literally and practically. So, you know, our pact is if I'm making a film, he doesn't do Edinburgh that year, because otherwise we genuinely wouldn't see each other for the entire year. So that was great. He was able to come out and spend some time with me. And, you know, the good thing is when I'm filming, at least I'm usually in one or two places for a long period of time. It's not that I'm in a different city every week. Whereas with you guys, it can be like, you know, pin the tail on the donkey. You just don't know where you're gonna be. So it's that, really. It's finding a balance, I guess.
What's the greatest thing you've gotten out of your life in filmmaking?
Oh, the enormous pleasure and privilege of getting to spend my life telling stories. I mean, you can't ask for more. And also to just about scrape a living at it. You know, that's a real privilege, to not have to have a day job or not have to, you know, to be in a position where I'm earning my living for the most part just doing the projects I want to do. That's extraordinary.
If you and your father could ever make a film together with unlimited money.
We've talked about it. Actually, we've
if you guys could do
it.
The ultimate father-daughter dream project.
It would actually be a
this
TV
This is our statement
TV
to humanity.
Series. We've got a TV series, but I can't talk too much about it. But it would be a generational, big, sweeping, epic thing. I would love to work. Well, we have worked together quite a few times. I've directed him. He's directed me. I've produced for him. And I'll have him act for me again. He's fantastic. So, yeah, I would love to do something with him.
What is the greatest advice you've ever been given as a filmmaker?
Never give up. Never give up. Unless it is really looking as though you are deluded about your talents. In which case, it's too cruel. You know, the business is really tough. I mean, I guess the same advice you would give to a wannabe comedian or actor or writer. If and it's very hard, because this all sounds real kind of sentimental, you know, if you feel there's nothing else you can possibly do, and if you have to absolutely do it, then never give up. I think it's not, these days, there's kind of no excuse not to go off and have a go at making a little film. You know, you can get your mates together, you can get a camera together, practice your craft a bit. It is a rough business, so you need to be hard-headed on the one hand, and I think be realistic on the other. Are you genuinely talented? A lot of people think they can pick up a camera and that's movie making. There's a little bit more to it than that. So I think be honest, genuinely honest with yourself. But if you are definitely the new Bergman, then just don't give up.
What's the greatest advice you've ever been given as a writer?
Never give up. Finish what you started. Keep going, because the temptation, both on a small and a big scale, is to quit two-thirds of the way through. I've found that on every piece I've ever written, is that I get the two-thirds of the way through crisis. It's quite easy to start something.
The two-thirds on the way through crisis.
Yeah, it's very easy to start something. It's very, very difficult to finish it. You get the panic, you get the fear as you move towards the ending, or I do anyway, and that's usually because it's not turned out the way it should in your head, and actually if you finish something, it's going to be what it is. So on a small scale, finish what you started, and also on a big scale too. Don't let your temperament get the better of you, you know.
Okay. What is your favorite place in London?
Bloody hell, that's a hard question. My favorite place in London. You mean restaurant or just place?
It's open to interpretation.
Well, you know what? I'm going to be really, really domestic and say that my favorite place in London is where I live, which is right on the top of Harrow on the Hill.
I can't visit that as a tourist.
You can. It has a view that it's the tallest hill in London.
Okay.
So it has a view that on a clear day you can see right out to Oxford.
I thought that, what was it, Primrose Hill? That's not
no,
the tallest?
No, we're taller. We're taller than Primrose.
Really? And what's the name of it?
Harrow on the Hill.
Harrow
and
on
it's
the
very,
hill.
Very beautiful.
Okay. What did you think of my Soho Theatre show?
I thought you were absolutely brilliant, as you know, I thought. Well, I love your stuff. I mean, I came to see you in Dublin. I've been to see you. Did I come and see you in Amsterdam? I think I did.
Yes, you did.
Yeah,
yes,
so,
you did.
You know,
you've seen me in three countries.
And I'm absolutely thrilled you had such a great run here.
Thank you.
And I hope it's the start of many more in London. I would love to have you back here more.
Thanks. So I really appreciate you supporting me as a friend. And your friendship
anytime,
means a lot to me. I adore you and your husband, Keith. I love having great conversation with intelligent, funny, cool people. And you guys have been, true great friends.
Well,
so
thank you, Tom. We feel the same way. So come back and visit.
I will. In closing, is there any advice or words of wisdom that you'd like to give the people of the earth?
Jesus. Is that enough, oh Jesus? I think that'll do.
All right, perfect.
Thanks, love.
All right, my friend, long may you run.